Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Well, you know, this world is filled with such immense beauty. So when you go and study the lives and travels of some of the most famous artists throughout history, not surprising to find that nature and landscape has influenced so much of their work. Janine Burke is an art historian and curator from Monash University, and she's written this fascinating book called Source, S-O-U-R-C-E, Source. It studies the lives of artists and writers from Monet to Pollock, Picasso to Hemingway, to show how their art has been shaped by the natural world. She's on the line now. Janine, welcome to Open House.
Thank you very much, Sheridan. Great to be here.
What first got you thinking about, the connection between creativity and place?
Well, I'd written a biography of Sunday Reid, the great Australian arts patron, and her home at Heidi outside Melbourne, where she had a kind of an artist's community lived there. And Sunday was really devoted to nature, and she was a very brilliant gardener as well. And it was by looking at her relationship with the natural world and how she influenced people like Sidney Nolan and Arthur Boyd and Albert Tucker and Joy Hester, that I really wanted to expand that and look at it on a more international level and see if this relationship between nature was as fecund and as fertile in major artists, say like Picasso or Pollock, Ernest Hemingway. Look, I basically just chose the people whose work I really like. And also, practically everywhere I went, there is a house museum. So, you know, you can visit Hemingway's house museum in Key West, you can visit Georgia O'Keeffe out in New Mexico, or Virginia Woolf in Sussex. So it's a book about journeys.
And then that connection to the creative process. You actually say in the book, in the introduction, you say the artistic process is a journey, the return to a lost and cherished childhood dream. What do you mean by that?
Well, this was a really extraordinary discovery that I made when I practically finished writing the book. And, you know, it was very much about how all these people went to these different places, often with kind of great difficulty, you know, setting up this new way of life for themselves, making a break with the past. And then curiously, when I looked into their childhood, they all had a very beautiful, natural place that was a kind of place of enchantment, childhood enchantment to them. And I just explore the notion that perhaps they were all trying to find their way back to and come back into contact with this marvellous childhood world, which in fact engendered, when they did find their way back there, an extraordinary change in their own artistic process and a new and very dramatic body of work.
Their own kind of personal Eden.
Exactly, their own personal Eden. And it was, you know, I didn't set out to track that in the book, but it just kind of really, really hit me. You know, particularly, say, someone like Jackson Pollock, who, you know, in his early life, led a kind of itinerant life in, you know, kind of the outback of Northern California and in Wyoming, and, you know, moved to New York, which was such an enormously influential place for him to be. But it was when he moved out to Long Island with his wife, Lee Krasner, that and got back in touch with nature in a way that he really was very closely attuned to the seasons, to the cycle of the moon. And this is where, you know, when he was living on Long Island, he began the big drip paintings, which you know, he's so very famous. And I couldn't help but think this walking that he would walk through the, you know, the forests and walk along the coastline, and I felt he was bringing that kind of intimate relationship with the natural world, a spatial relationship. So this, you know, it was really quite a fascinating way into what was, for, you know, everybody in the book, a great shift in their creative process, which was engendered by a shift into this new relationship with landscape.
Yes, okay, going and getting that re-enchantment by getting back in touch with nature.
Exactly.
I mean, would you say that for a good deal of the artists you looked at, if not all of them, I mean, was their best work coming out of that season?
Yes, exactly.
Their best work
their
came
best
out when
work.
They were really, really engaged in nature.
Their most original work was coming out of this reinvigorated relationship with the natural world, this loss of this childhood Eden that was often quite painful for them, and it seems like as I, you know, it's put forward this notion, I can't totally prove it, but put forward this notion that by finding their way back, they produce the works, the kind of classic works that we know all these people for, you know, yeah. Monet's Wall Lily paintings and Pollock's drip paintings, Georgia O'Keeffe's, you know, amazing desert paintings, etc., etc.
Now, I wonder how many artists would agree with us and be nodding their head as they're listening to us.
I'd like to know. If they're living in the country, they probably would be saying, yeah, I did that thing myself.
Yeah, you know? Or saying, yeah, why am I holed up in this little one-bedroom unit in the city? Struggling to make a living, and I should be out in nature. 1-300-40-2020 if you're an artist and you resonate with what we're talking about. This is Open House. Janine Burke is the author of Source. We're talking about how for so many of these famous artists, it was really when they got back to nature that they really produced their best work. Okay, Picasso. Talk about then his move from the city to the country and then how that influenced his greatest work.
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting one because Picasso, of course, was based in Paris and that's where he'd made his name. But, of course, as a child, he'd lived in Spain. He was Spanish. And his family, again, had this kind of funny itinerant. It seems to be true of a lot of the artists and writers I looked at. Again, maybe I chose them unconsciously, but they'd all had this kind of slightly itinerant childhood. And for Picasso, his family went up to a very small town right up on the kind of Iberian Peninsula in the north of Spain. And it was there he actually started drawing. You know, it was there he, in a sense, discovered his own genius, in this place by the sea, in this amazing tower that I think the Romans had actually built, which is still there. And then, curiously enough, when he decides to live in Provence, he finds this marvellous old chateau by the sea. Again, it's a sort of a tower, like the tower that he found in his childhood. And he becomes completely inspired by the Mediterranean coastline and by classical mythology. And, you know, as he said, you know, all these fauns and these gods and these, you know, creatures that I draw, they only come into my art when I'm here by the sea in the Mediterranean. And he basically abandoned Paris at that point. He'd go back there for exhibitions, but he lived in Provence and he lived along that coastline for the rest of his very long life because he lived until he was about 90.
That's fascinating. Okay, Hemingway. Let's go to some writers. Then Hemingway, he makes the move to Florida. He's what, just turning 30 or something like that. That turns out to be the turning point for his art.
Absolutely, yes. And again, I mean, he was based in Paris and, you know, very famously was part of the circle that, you know, Picasso was part of that circle, Gertrude Stein, you know, James Joyce. I mean, many of the major modernists of that particular period in the 1920s. And then he returns to this amazing, you know, he goes to Key West in Florida, which then was, you know, completely one of the most remote places you could possibly be, and kind of abandons, like, the kind of high culture that he's been part of. And again, for Hemingway, you know, there was this, he had this incredible childhood, you know, particularly with his father, who was somebody who knew an enormous amount about nature and taught him to, you know, to camp and to fish and to shoot and to, you know, to live in the wilderness. And he kind of creates this world for himself, or recreates this world for himself in Key West. And he's finishing, you know, the major novel that we know of, A Farewell to Arms, which is possibly his most famous work and I would say his most brilliant work. He finishes that there. And it's interesting just reading that novel because he'd started it in Paris. And he finishes it in Key West, and there's so much about water, you know, as a sort of major metaphor in the writing that sort of like just swirls into the narrative. And Hemingway himself is constantly out fishing, constantly out on the Gulf of Mexico with his buddies and just spending time on the water and really finding it a very healing place to be. He talks about that a lot. And even when, you know, the book comes out, it's a big success, he just keeps writing to his publisher saying, I've just got to get back to Key West because that's, you know, that's where I know who I am. That's where I really have to be.
Yeah, interesting. Now, many Aboriginal artists, of course, are very heavily influenced by landscape. You do a bit of focus on Emily Kame Angware.
Yes, indeed.
I got the pronunciation
right
there. Yeah. you know, a famous Australian Aboriginal artist in the way that, again, landscape just has such an important role to play in Indigenous art.
Well, for Aboriginal people, there is nothing outside landscape, you know, because the land owns the people, not the other way around. So their relationship with the land is profound, and all of their art is coming out of, it's like diagrams of that relationship with the landscape, diagrams of what's known as the dreaming, but it's actually a series of myths and laws about how to conduct oneself in relation to the landscape. And, of course, for them, spirituality is paramount. Again, there's nothing outside their spirituality because the land is alive, you know, with mythic beings. And their job as traditional people is to continue to engage with those mythic beings. They're looking after the land. They're the custodians, they're the caretakers, you know, they're the mothers and fathers of the land. That's their job as traditional Aboriginal people. And so what they paint and what they draw is completely, you know, in a very harmonious relationship with that.
Yes. Touching on that issue of spirituality, you touch in the book about the fact that so many of the artists that you're exploring in the book Source were actually either animists or pantheists or something along those lines. Now, you know, this program comes from a Christian perspective. The Christian understanding of God is not pantheism. There's a fundamental separation between God and his creation. But I find it fascinating that so many of them looked at the beauty of the world and then said, there's something divine about this. We would probably understand that differently, but there's something divine about this. I find that fascinating.
Yes, I think that's very true. And I think it's probably difficult for some of them to express that at different times because these ideas have been seen as like anti-intellectual or something like that to talk about this notion of spirituality and landscape and feeling at one with it and learning from it. Yes, and feeling it has a divine essence, that it is actually a representation of the sacred.
Hmm.
And that was a very, very profound connection pretty much all of these people had with landscape.
Now, that could also help us understand why when we look at some of the artworks from some of these people that you're talking about, we can also have profound feelings of spirituality or profound feelings of awe or a sense that there is something sacred, something divine that's been captured here. If that's what they saw, and then that's what they painted, and then we're kind of looking at it through their eyes in some ways.
Yes, I think that's very true. Hmm. And I think they wanted us to do that.
Hmm.
You know, and I think the richness of a lot of this work has to do with that, those deep levels and layers of what would be called spiritual content that has come out of their not only profound sort of like a topographical study of the landscape, like walking through it and knowing it and being in contact with it in various ways, but, yeah, seeing it as sacred and wanting to express that themselves in their own way, whether through words or through painting, and imparting that to us. I mean, for somebody like Emily Ngware, of course, there's no argument about that. I mean, that's absolutely what she and Aboriginal people do. They're talking about a spiritual environment that they inhabit,
yes.
Where sort of the past and the present just sort of collapses into one sort of unity. And for other people, I think probably for them too, to actually gain their connection with the spiritual world, they kind of did have to go on these journeys. And I think that's why they all found, you know, these places of healing, you know, whether it was Provence or whether it was the New Mexico desert, they were vitally and deeply engaged with what we all know, for ourselves is also a spiritual journey, which we engage.
Mm.
You know, I mean, even Monet, who didn't really talk about his art at all, I mean, he was extremely silent about what he was doing. I mean, you look at, you know, the late water lily paintings, they are so profoundly beautiful, and you are so deeply moved by his engagement with light and with beauty that he obviously worships it, you know,
and he's
presenting that worship of it to us and asking us to engage in it also.
Very interesting. The thing that comes to mind is as a Christian, as the first chapter of Romans, it talks about God's invisible qualities being seen in the world, you know, his beauty and power and goodness, so that we're all without excuse. That's where I go. It's just very interesting to see just the way artists have picked up on that kind of thing. Well, what does this mean for the artists that are listening, Janine? Do we all pack up, run to the hills, or head out to the beachside shack? Is that where our best work is going to be?
Now, look, all you have to do is look out your window. There's sky, There are birds, you know. There's a lot to see in an urban environment as well. You can be deeply in touch with nature in an urban environment and chart the seasons and watch the phases of the moon and see what new stars are coming into the sky with each season. It's all there. I mean they made it sort of like extraordinary and extreme journeys. Maybe they needed to. Maybe that's what they had to do. But I think for all of us, we can like be profoundly aware of nature and grateful to it and in awe of it, yeah, by just looking out the window of our flats or something, or our backyards.
Well, you certainly have to say that when you work at Monash.
Fortunately, I have an amazing view that stretches all the way to across Port Phillip Bay to Mount Martha, so I'm quite pleased. I can commune on a daily basis with the natural world.
Do you ever, you know, get out and do your own kind of pilgrimage yourself, though, to do your writing or anything else?
Yes, I do. I mean, it was amazing going to all these places. You know, I went to Kenya and Copenhagen and, you know, tramping through the New Mexico desert, which must be one of the most extraordinary landscapes you could ever experience, going out to the central desert to look at the places where Emily Enware lived and painted. And, yeah, I have my own wonderful sites. You know, there are lots of lovely places that I visit regularly, maybe Apollo Bay, you know, down on the Great Ocean Road is a pretty wonderful place.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating to talk to, Janine. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Sheridan.
Yeah, art historian and curator and author, Janine Burke. She's the author of this book, Source, on how so many of these famous artists, Picasso, Pollock, Hemingway, we've only just kind of scratched the surface of the amount of artists that she looks at in the book, were just so profoundly moved by nature. And in fact, their best work came out of their time when they were closest to nature.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.